Last thing I wanted to talk about was the decay Higgs to BB bar. And the Feynman rule is pretty simple. It's minus I MB over V. And you can compute the decay rate from that. So this is the Higgs. This would be the B and the B bar. And it's something like 3 over 8 pi mb squared over v squared mh. If I did it right, the 3 is just from the sum over colors. And the only point I want to make is that this mb, to make the strong interaction perturbation series as well behaved as you can, at least by choice of subtraction point, we should choose it to be evaluated at the Higgs mass. But the way we usually determine the bottom quark mass is by measurements made at much lower energies, at around 5 GeV or 10 GeV. Well, this is 125 GeV, GeV for GeV. And so we really want to evaluate this at something like, so if you have the BB bar bound state, the one that's, you know, the properties of best is called the bound state. It's called the upsilon. It's the one with the same quantum numbers as the photon under JPC, 1 minus minus. Makes it easy to make an E plus E minus collisions. And so you really want to take this and evaluate. So the measurements measure something like this, M upsilon over 2, this choice of subtraction point, which is much lower than this. We want to be able to take this, which is measured, it's about 4.5 GeV, and move it to this. And so for that, you use the renormalization group. That tells you how things depend on subtraction point. So I'm just going to sketch that very quickly, so then we can move on. And so remember how those arguments go. It's the same as the, it's basically the same idea as the beta function. So you have a bare mass, which is the thing you start. You start setting up the theory, regulated in 4 minus epsilon dimensions, or some other less practical way if you want to. Yes.
So is the theory still perturbative at n epsilon?
Yes. So this is a number around 5 GeV, and it becomes non-perturbative around 1 GeV. Although few people would run all the way down to 1 GeV, most people stop around 2 to be safe. So it's still perturbative there, yes. All hell breaks loose, of course, around a few hundred MeV. That would be, but yeah. OK, so it's still perturbative. That's a very important point, because we only calculate the beta function at a certain order, or the, in this case, it's called an anomalous dimension at a certain order in perturbation theory. So you have something like this. This is the renormalized parameter, which depends on subtraction point. And we calculated Zm in the case of the electron from a diagram like this, where this was an electron and this is a photon. So if we want to get Zm from Zm electron, we can just copy down the answer and make some substitutions. So before we had an E squared here, so I guess I should say Zm equals Zm electron with the following substitutions. So E squared is going to go to G squared, and then we're going to get TA, which is 4/3 times the identity, so you'll just get 4/3. And here I'm not sure I'm going to get the signs right, because I didn't go back over my notes the way I'm supposed to this morning. But so we might end up with the wrong sign. I'll fix it up in my final version of the notes. It's a risk here, because I didn't look back. So I think it's this. And so what do we want to do? We want to derive a renormalization group equation. So we're going to say 0 equals mu d by d mu of mb naught. The bare parameter doesn't depend on u, which is mu d by d mu of this thing we calculate in perturbation theory, zm, times mb plus zm mu d by d mu of mb. And so now we take this over to one side, and we get mu d by d mu of mb is equal to minus 1 over zm. Looks a lot like the beta function one. Right?
So is that epsilon in the denominator of zm?
Yes. Doesn't look like an epsilon. No. It's close. Of course, close only counts in horseshoes. Okay, so, and there's an MB here. So we need to get this quantity in perturbation theory. And so all the mu dependence in ZM comes from the mu dependence of G. So beta of G is equal to mu d by d mu of G. And it starts off as minus epsilon over 2 times g plus dot, dot, dot. That's the only term we'll need here. So I'm going to get 2 mu by d mu of g here. And so I'll get a minus epsilon, which kills that epsilon, which makes the 8 a plus. So I get 1 over zm mu d by d mu of zm is 8 g squared over 16 pi squared. Where? What? Well, so when we went back and defined our renormalized coupling in terms of our bare coupling G, we put in this mu to the epsilon factor because we wanted our renormalized G to be dimensionless. That's where this part comes from, and the rest comes from a real serious calculation, which won 3 scientists the Nobel Prize. Calculations that win you a Nobel Prize will not be done during the lecture. I figure they're too hard by and large. Okay, so we got to put this together. Usually you write the equation like this, mu d by d mu of mb equals gamma m of g times mb. And because we have the minus sign here, a plus sign here, gamma m of g is equal to minus 8 g squared over 16 pi squared. And so as we increase the subtraction point, this is a negative number, the bottom quark mass gets smaller. So the rate's going to be smaller for Higgs to BB bar than if we plugged in the m epsilon over 2. Here's an interesting coincidence. If you take the mb, the B quark mass, and you evaluate it at the ginormous scale, ginormous is a scientific word, of 10 to the 15 GeV, that comes out almost equal to the tau mass. And there's some theories that predict this, actually. Rand unified theories have that relation, so it's considered one of the successes of those theories. They also have a sequence of other relations that fail miserably, which we tend not to talk about. Anyways, okay, so we got to solve for mb of mu. Relate mb at some mu 2 to mb of another mu 1, of mu 1. And the solution looks like this. It's just a first order differential equation we're trying to solve. So if you want to check If you want to check that this is right, you take mu d by d mu of mu 2. Oh, I forgot something. Then there's mb of mu 1. So you take mu 2 d by d mu 2 of this. So only this gets differentiated. Well, then you get this back thing times the derivative of g2 times this. But the derivative of g of mu 2 produces the beta function. And so you get back gamma m, so you get back this differential equation. So it satisfies the differential equation, and it satisfies the right boundary condition. So this is the solution. It's a first-order differential equation. And so then you stick in the values of gamma m we just calculated and beta from before. This goes like g squared. This goes like g cubed. It's a 1 over g. Integral gives you a logarithm of the ratio of those. Exponential of the logarithm gives you a ratio of these to the power. And then you convert that to the ratio of alphas to the power by taking half the power. And so that's how you end up with this following formula. Putting in all the numbers, you end up with the following. What is this a formula for? I have very bad notes on this, which I must fix. I'm sorry. So you end up with a formula that says mb of mu 2 is equal to alpha s of mu 2 alpha s of mu 1 to a power c over 2. Let me just write the power. And the appropriate number of quark flavors to put in are the quarks whose masses lie in the range between these two mu's. And then it's so one more thing. Because I can't believe I didn't even plug in the numbers. I'll do that too before and repost the notes. I don't know what happened to me. One more thing. We solved this renormalization group equation. It's important to understand what did we actually sum? What did we actually do in terms of perturbation theory? And so when you have an expression like this, I could re-express alpha s at mu 2 in terms of alpha s at mu 1 and write this as a power series in, let's say, alpha s at mu 1. And what have we summed here? Well, it ends up that power series looks like has the following form. Plus another number, A1, all these A's will just be constants. You've summed up all the terms of order alpha times a log to any power in doing this. And remember, alpha s, it's only small. It falls like 1 over a log. So if you're going over a big enough range in the change of these two, then this is something of order 1 in QCD. So usually doing this part of the calculation, if the ratio of scales is large, is considered the leading part of the calculation. It's summing this with the renormalization group is not subdominant in any sense. It's the leading part. And then the corrections come from the following. They come from, let's say, two-loop anomalous dimensions. And they give you corrections that involve alpha s and no log, and alpha s squared and one log. So they're truly alpha s corrections. So in order to derive that the formula looks like this, I would write alpha s of mu 2. I would express it in terms of alpha s of mu 1 using a previous formula we had. So so this is mb of mu 2 equals something a series like this times mb of mu 1. Yeah. So I'm talking about expanding this out in a perturbative series. Yeah, thank you. Makes it a little clearer. So I think now you have all the methods to understand, you know, how to compute Higgs properties, some sense of the size of various effects. And you can find, you know, if you go to the particle data group, you can get all the numbers. It's kind of fun to go there and see how big things actually are. And they often have sections, review sections. Like they'll have a review one on the strong interactions, a review one on the weak interactions. They're pretty good to read to get some sense of the phenomenology. But, you know, this is only a 3-week class, and I want to introduce you to a few of the methods that are used in particle physics phenomenology, so we have to move on to a totally different topic, away from asymptotic freedom, and now to some other methods that are used. And the method I'm going to describe today is called chiral perturbation theory, or effective Lagrangians for spontaneously broken symmetries is a more general context. It's a very powerful method. It's used not just in particle physics, but also in condensed matter physics. And so let's step through that. So you gotta get readjusted.
So before we move on, could you say just a word or two about the meaning of anomalous dimensions?
Well, the anomalous dimensions, they tell you how the parameters evolve with the subtraction point. So that's really what they're all about. And the beta function is just another anomalous dimension. Sometimes the people call the anomalous dimension just a number. Here, a little bit. Sometimes they call it the coefficient of the g squared here without the beta function. So they just tell you how things evolve with subtraction point. And then, so then you need the piece of physics that tells you that it's preferential to choose the subtraction point near the scale of the physics of the problem, because that makes the calculation, either the perturbation theory that you use there, more well-behaved. And the other common thing you do in a given physical problem is you go over to an effective theory where you remove the degrees of freedom that are much heavier or irrelevant for the problem. Like, for example, if you do low-energy weak interactions, you usually don't have the W boson there explicitly. You go over to Fermi, like for muon decay, you replace the propagator by just minus G2 squared over MW squared, and it's as if there's no W boson there at all, and the whole Hamiltonian is just a 4-fermion operator. And you forget about the standard model and all the rest of the machinery because it's not relevant for that particular problem. So those are the two simplifying steps that you do when you can. So the more common thing would be maybe so getting to the end of here, that you might say the mass anomalous dimension is this whole number that tells you the scaling. I think that's actually, when I think about it, the more common use of the word. Because usually it's just a number you quote for an anomalous dimension. So it must be just a number like this. The coefficient of ratios like the coefficient of this gamma over beta with the 1 over g taken out. Tells you something scales with mu. Okay, so we're going to talk about chiral Lagrangians. Any other questions before we move on? So combining your TA sessions and what we've done in class, you've seen a lot of applications of asymptotic freedom. Production of hadrons at large energy, E plus E minus went to hadrons. Initial state involving hadrons producing something at large energies, like PP to Higgs. Decays of B mesons, where you use asymptotic freedom to say you can treat it just as a B quark decay. You make a little argument similar to other ones we did to say that that should be the first approximation. So all those are only possible because of asymptotic freedom. And then some physical argument based on what's often called the impulse approximation, or the separation of scales, probabilities that are one, because it must form hadrons in the end. Okay. So now we're back with the strong interactions, although we'll talk a little bit about weak interactions in this context. We want to look at the lowest lying mesons in the theory. So these are bound states. Every state in the strong interactions is ginormously complicated, because even the vacuum is ginormously complicated, an unfortunate circumstance. So if we look at the lowest states, they're pseudoscalar mesons, negative parity. So there's the pi zero, the pi plus, pi minus. They're the lightest. They have a mass of about 140 MeV. So 1,000 MeV is 1 GeV. Here people usually talk MeV and not GeV if you're in this business. So these have no strange, So these things under isospin form a triplet under isospin. So in the limit, and so for example, the pi minus, you could think of it as U bar D, an anti up and a down quark, and then in the bound state, and then there's all kinds of gluons and quark anti quark pairs that have a certain probability of being there. It's a complicated, non-perturbative bound state. No net strangeness, though. You could have a strange, anti-strange pair in the bound state, but no net strangeness. The things with net strangeness are k plus, k minus, k naught, k naught bar. So k naught, for example, so their masses are around 495 MeV. And the k naught, roughly speaking, as far as the flavor quantum numbers are concerned, is S bar down. And similarly, you can figure out what they are for the others. But remember, this does not say the bound state is a non-relativistic bound state of an anti-strange quark and a down quark. It's a complicated bound state, just like the proton was. And then there's something with an eta called the eta. And the mass of the eta is about 540 MeV. Let's see what that is, a little goal. So our goal for this part of this lecture, and maybe half of the next lecture, is to describe the strong interactions of these, at low energies, of these states. And that's a pretty daunting task, because we're fully into the non-perturbative regime. Asymptotic freedom is useless. Perturbation theory is useless. Sounds like we got to just head off to the pub, have a few beers, and celebrate our ignorance. But when perturbative methods aren't useful, often understanding symmetries and the pattern of symmetries is powerful. And that's what will give us power in this case. We're going to parametrize the things we don't know in terms of a few parameters, and we'll be able to predict several things in terms of just a few parameters. So there'll be relations we can make, things we can predict. So let's talk about symmetries. To understand the symmetries, we should go back to the fundamental Lagrangian, which is strong interactions in this case. So let's write it out. Let's write out LQCD. And this is all about the light quarks, the up, the down, and the strange. So all the rest of the quarks are irrelevant. We've integrated them out in the language I used before. So it's just a theory of up, down, and strange quarks. And if we look at the, so it looks like this. Where Q is a column vector here with three elements, and therefore this is a 3x3 matrix. And we diagonalize the quark masses. Okay. So the first thing to recall is that under Lorentz transformations, the left-handed component of a quark or lepton transforms this way, and the right-handed transforms like this way. They don't get mixed up. The lefts transform amongst the lefts, the rights transform amongst the rights. And so we can give the lefts and rights different quantum numbers, and it'll commute with Lorentz transformations. We don't have to worry about some bigger group structure that we'd have to invent. And we use that fact when we set up the standard model, because the left and right-handed quarks transform differently under the gauge group, similar for the leptons. And we're going to use this again. So remember how Q left and right are defined? Q left, for example, is a half 1 minus gamma 5 in terms of the Dirac notation, and Q right. Any questions? Yeah?
Could that be a minus sign before the mass part?
Yeah, thank you. I wonder if I have any money today. Geez, I have no money. Congratulations, thank you. Sorry, sitting on my desk. Yeah. Okay, so these quark masses, we said they were small. These are the light quarks. They have small masses. So why don't we start to first understand the theory in the limit where the quark masses are actually zero. They're small. We should be able to treat them as a perturbation in the end. So if that's what it means by small, at least in some sense, that we're a bit more explicit about. So let's start off by neglecting them. So neglect MQ. So now let's look at the theory. So if we look at the theory, I can now write LQCD. It keeps getting simpler and simpler. So now it's I, and I'm going to split it up like this. Oops, too many I's. So the kinetic term, the D slash term in the Lagrangian, it couples left to left, right to right. Doesn't mix up left with right. Mass terms mix up left with right. You with me? So now we want to step back for a second and not fall off the edge. Take a look at this and ask, what symmetries, what global symmetries does this theory have? You know, if you can't use perturbation theory, you got to use symmetries. That's all you got, unless you're powerful with computers and can do non-perturbative simulation. I am not. Well, that's just the structure of this term. You know, if there was a left with a right, once you moved it through, you'd get like 1 minus gamma 5 times 1 plus gamma 5, you'd get 0. So that's a little gamma matrix algebra. But mass terms do mix them, because you don't, like when you take the bar out, it becomes the opposite gamma 5. And you want me to write something out about that? Like, if you have Q bar left, what you can do is you can use the gamma matrix algebra. That becomes 1 plus gamma 5 over 2 on this side. And so if you have Q right here, then 1 plus gamma 5 over 2 times 1 plus gamma 5 over 2, that's fine. You know, that just gives you 1 plus gamma 5 over 2 again. But if you have Q left, you'll get 0. But if I have a gamma matrix in between, I move it through, and it'll work out fine again. So that's the origin of this, knowing the Dirac algebra. So anybody want to hazard a guess as to the symmetries? Well, we know the symmetries now. I could take Q left, and I could transform it by a 3x3 unitary matrix. Oh, let me call it Q left prime, which equals L. Let me actually break up into special unitary, and then there'll be U1 factors, which we'll talk about later. So let's make it special unitary. So that's SU3. And I'm transforming the left-handed one, so I'll call it SU3 left. This is a 3x3 special unitary matrix. So what I'm going to get on this is L dagger L, and so it'll be 1. So this term is invariant under that. Is that clear? And similarly, we have an SU3 right symmetry. So our theory in the limit where the quark mass goes to 0, the quark masses go to 0, there's an SU3 left cross SU3 right. That's called chiral symmetry because the left and right transform differently. If they transform the same, then it's a vector-like symmetry. It's a notation you use. In addition, there's two U1 symmetries. You can call them a separate U1 left or a separate U1 right, or you can take different linear combinations, vector and axial. And let me talk about it in terms of vector and axial. Vector is where the left and rights transform the same way, and axial is where the left and rights transform with the opposite phase in the U1 transformation. When they transform with the same phase, that symmetry is baryon number. Another symmetry you've heard about, at least approximately conserved in nature. It's actually not conserved in the standard model because of something called anomalies, but that's an extremely small effect at low momentum. I haven't taught you about anomalies at all, and maybe that'll come in the second part of this. Was there any discussion of anomalies in field theory?
No.
The U1, so anomalies, what happens is some symmetries, this is a symmetry of the Lagrangian. Sometimes when you do quantum corrections, the quantum corrections actually violate this classical symmetry, and that's called an anomaly. Yeah?
It's just to kind of make it, in the axial one, the phase factors are just opposite, right?
Yeah, so all the quarks left would transform like e to the I alpha q left, and all the rights would transform like e to the minus I. That's the axial. The axial actually is not a symmetry. It has an anomaly. So we don't usually discuss it in this business. So basically, the symmetries that survive quantum corrections are SU3 left cross SU3 right cross U1 baryon number.
Did you say baryon number is the quantum number associated with vector symmetry?
Right. Because all the quarks transform the same way. Same face, you could give them a charge, let's say 1/3. And that's all the same. And so that's the same as baryon number. All the quarks have the same baryon number.
And how can I see that this U1 symmetry is different from the exact U1 symmetry from the standard model? The one we already had?
Oh, you'd have to, it would require a whole lecture, maybe a lecture and a half to discuss anomalies, It's very subtle. You know, maybe it'll be done in the second part of this. I'm going to talk to Itai later about the things I didn't do. That'll be up to them.
This is a global symmetry, right?
It's a global symmetry, right. But still, global symmetries can have anomalies too.
Right.
And they can mean that they're not realized. Okay, so what we have, we're going to focus on the SU3 left cross SU3 right part. We have that symmetry. It's not visible on the spectrum. When you have a global symmetry, you have charges that commute with the Hamiltonian, you have degenerate multiplets that fall into representations of that symmetry, and the spectrum does not look like SU3 left cross SU3 right. Murray Gell-Mann won the Nobel Prize for figuring out what these symmetries are, and it was just SU3. There was no two SU3s. It would be different, bigger multiplets. So something's rotten with respect to these symmetries. Something's wrong. And so we know how it's got to work. We know there's an SU3, and Murray Gell-Mann's symmetry, what he worked out was the SU3 vector symmetry. We know that's approximately realized. Yes? Well, it would mean particles would fall into multiplets of it. And so, you know, if it's, what happens, for example, is the mesons form an octet. There'd have to be another octet, which the, you know, sort of parity doubled, because you have two SU3s. So, it would just be bigger multiplets. There'd be more states that have the same mass. The particles fill out one octet, and it ends up, we know that's associated with the vector subgroup. And so we have this symmetry of the Lagrangian. It's not manifest in the spectrum. A subgroup's manifest, and you know, the usual way you implement that is the symmetry spontaneously broken to the subgroup that you see manifest in the spectrum. So we want to have SU3 left cross SU3 right.
I broke this.
Hold on while I take 20 minutes putting back the...
Now the voice from the sky is going to come and
hear. Yeah, that's right. I'm going to be punished by God. Oops. Well, it's fixable, but I can't get this in real time. Are you still there? Okay.
I'll come right down.
No. I got it. It's okay. Don't come down. I'm okay. I'm hooked up. We're good to go. This is SU3 vector. That's what we want. And when we had the standard model, we were breaking the gauge group. We introduced this fundamental thing, the Higgs field. We got no room to introduce a Higgs field or anything. We got to make up the thing that gets a vacuum expectation value that breaks this symmetry out of degrees of freedom in the strong interactions. It's supposed to be the right theory. We got to write something down, some operator who can get a vacuum expectation value and spontaneously break this symmetry. But it can be a composite operator, an operator made up of products of fields that exist in the theory. So, of course, it's got to be a color singlet operator because we don't want to break color. Because that wouldn't agree with the phenomenology either. So here's an operator, OKJ. Now I'm putting indices on. Q bar right, Q left, K. This is J, this is K. The color indices, look at I'm putting color indices on. I have to put them in color. Pink. I like pink, actually. But I don't have the courage to wear a pink shirt. I think I'm going to buy a pink shirt when I get back to LA. Sorry, that's a little too personal. So it's a color singlet operator. Each of these indices goes over 1, 2, 3 for up, down, strange. So in some sense, it's a lot of operators. You with me so far with the notation? If you don't understand the notation, you will be lost subsequently. It's guaranteed. You might be lost anyways, but it's not guaranteed. Yes? Oh, I haven't got to that part yet. First, I'm writing down an operator. And now I'm going to tell you that it has a vacuum expectation value. So it's a color singlet, some number with dimensions of mass to the power 3, and it's diagonal. And I'll tell you why in a moment. So this is a non-perturbative fact. You could try to verify it using lattice QCD. I claim that in the strong interactions, theory of QCD, if I put down this operator and calculate its vacuum expectation value, you get something with units of GeV cubed, V. It's not the same V that broke the weak interactions, it's a different vacuum expectation value. How does this operator transform under the SU3 left cross SU3 right symmetry? Let's get that straight. So this is Q bar right prime J, Q left prime K, which is LKP. In terms of these operators in SU3 left, in terms of these matrices in SU3 left and SU3 right, I don't think there's any difference between upper and lower indices here. I don't know why I did this, but anyways. R star, because of the bar, JS. And then I get back O again. And the J was the P. Let's see, I'm going to get this right. No, the K was the P. Good. Does everybody see that? So I can write this in matrix notation as LOR dagger times KJ. So that's how O transforms under this global symmetry. So L, so then we could go to full matrix notation, O prime, O goes to O prime equals L O R dagger, viewing this as a 3x3 matrix of operators. Okay. Uh-oh, to use a big eraser. Oh well. Sometimes you just gotta do it. Pardon? Well, that's what it was. You can't, so you might ask about gauging this chiral symmetry, but the quark masses don't respect it. So it's not an exact global symmetry. We're treating it as an approximate symmetry. We're going to study the theory in that limit. And you can only gauge things that are exact symmetry.
Do you mean, symmetry with respect to this global
transformation? I thought the question was, could I... You can gauge symmetries that are spontaneously broken, and then you get the Higgs mechanism. But at the Lagrangian level, they have to be exact symmetries. And so the quark masses explicitly break the symmetry, not spontaneously, and that you cannot gauge.
So is this O corresponds to the Higgs field?
No. This O, well... Maybe you should finish the sentence. So the Higgs field was a fundamental field we added to the Lagrangian, and there's a particle excitation associated with it, and it broke the weak interactions, gave the W boson mass. So this O, you know, is this operator. Here's the quark field. This is what it is in terms of the quarks in the theory. It's already there. We don't have to add anything extra. It's just made up of the fields in the problem. What's called a composite operator because it's not a single field. And they're both at the same space-time point. It's a local operator.
I just want to compare this one to the Higgs field. So, yeah, so if you say this is just a field you add in this theory, then is it the excitation field, like the small h in the Higgs mechanism?
No. It's more analogous to the Higgs doublet that we started with. So, but it's not a new thing we add. It's already there in the theory. This operator, you know, this is the theory. If we say this is the theory, we don't have to add anything else to break the symmetry. We just look at this operator and it gets a vacuum expectation value. That help at all? But it's playing the same role that the Higgs field did for breaking the weak interaction. Yeah, a lot of physics in this. It's not, you know, it's good to ask questions.
Excuse me?
Mm-hmm.
The Q by Q expectation value is non-zero even the quark mass are zero, right?
Yes.
And I expect the operator breaks maybe U1B or U1 asymmetry instead of these SUs.
It won't break the U1V. Because all of these transform with the same phase. So it certainly won't break the U1V, and the U1A is not there anyway, so because of anomaly. Right? Under the vector subgroup, the quarks, both left and right, transform with the same phase. So I'll get the phase here, opposite phase here. It'll be e to the I alpha, e to the minus I alpha. It won't transform. So it doesn't break baryon number. Okay? Okay, so let's go ahead and let's see how the vacuum expectation value transforms. So we already know that O, so what do I want to look at? I want to look at the expectation value of O prime KJ. Well, this goes over to L O R dagger KJ. And these are just matrices. They can be pulled outside. So the whole thing, so I can put in the expectation value of O there. So I get L, V. And in this matrix notation, this is just the identity matrix. So it's V times the identity matrix, R dagger, O, and it's still KJ. And so what do we got here, team? We've got, well, the identity, we can take the V out front. We got L, R dagger, KJ. Okay, so why did I do this? Well, the unbroken subgroup are those that don't change the vacuum expectation value. And so I should ask, for what L and what R is this the same as O, KJ, which was just V delta KJ? So anybody want to tell me? I'll shake your hand. Not enough incentive. I can hardly blame you. Well, if L is equal to R, these are unitary matrices, this is the identity, delta KJ. So the unbroken subgroup are those transformations for which the left-handed equal the right. So the subgroup where L equals R is still an SU3, and that's called the SU3 vector subgroup. The lefts and rights transform the same way. And so we have shown that giving this the vacuum expectation value I said, indeed, does spontaneously break SU3 left times SU3 right to an SU3 subgroup, which is the vector subgroup. So if we think of some potential for the composite operator O in the non-perturbative theory of strong interactions, the generators of the global symmetry, the SU3 left cross SU3 right, that move you in a direction of field space, don't leave it invariant. Those excitations, those directions won't cost you any extra potential energy. There'll be massless particles associated with it. In this case, it's the axial transformations that do that, the parity negative transformations in some sense. So the massless particles associated with those excitations, they'll have opposite parity from the vacuum, and there's supposed to be eight of them. Because there's eight broken generators, we have one less SU3, and that's all these particles I've written down there. So at the level we've done this analysis, neglecting the quark masses, all of these particles are massless as a consequence of this symmetry breaking. So we have eight massless particles. Well, they're not massless. I told you they're masses. Well, that's because the quark masses are not zero. We'll put them in a moment, but let's still continue in this imaginary world. Isn't it great to be a theoretical physicist? If you're just a regular guy or gal and you have this imaginary world you carry around with you all the time, you end up on very bad drugs or in a home. But we can do it all the time. Yeah?
So the broken generators are the ones which correspond to those particles there.
Right. So since the vector is unbroken, you could break this up into vector and axial transformations, and the SU3 axial would be broken.
And that's not anomalous.
And that's not anomalous. Just the U1 subgroup.
U1 subgroup is anomalous.
So again, I haven't shown you that. There's just so much I can do. It really is. Anomalies are very subtle. It's really at least a lecture if I'm going to do anything reasonable on that. I'm slightly more advanced, actually, than what I'm doing. But you would still understand it. So we want to write some theory of these degrees of freedom that are still massless, and they correspond to the directions in the transformation in field space that takes us away from this vacuum. But look at this is the object that does that, this LR dagger. So they live in O in some sense. We have this OKJ. And I'm going to represent it like this, V sigma of X, KJ. And all the excitations, these massless particles, the fields, live in this matrix. And it's a unitary matrix because this is unitary. We just promoted this constant thing to something that depends on fields. And it transforms like O. And so sigma goes to sigma prime, which is L sigma R dagger. So these massless particles, massless at this level, the pi, the k, the eta, they're going to live inside this 3x3 unitary matrix sigma. And wait one more second. And sigma will go to left sigma, right dagger, just like O under these transformations. Yes? So O was this matrix, this composite operator, Q bar Q. And so it's a composite field, it's a field. And that field has a vacuum expectation value, and it has certain directions also that are excitations about that expectation value, just like the fundamental Higgs field. And so those directions in field space correspond to these particles pi, k, and eta. And I want to parametrize them. So the only thing I've added here is that this is a 3x3 unitary matrix, because I noticed that that's what it goes to under these transformations. So that's where the field should lie. It's a field operator whose excitations correspond to those particles. Yeah, that's kind of sloppy language. I'm a sloppy guy. Look at my shirt's not tight. So not everybody uses this. There's other ways to represent it, but this is what I do. The reason there's other ways to represent it is that when you have a field theory, you can always make field redefinitions and represent things in different ways. But these massless particles in field space, this composite operator is a field. In field space, they live in the directions when you transform that operator by the broken generator. And so that's this matrix here. We just promoted to having space-time dependence to be a field once we figured out what the directions were. Okay, so it's unitary. So I can write it as exponential 2i. The 2 is my convention, m over some constant, and then m will be a traceless Hermitian matrix of fields. I haven't done anything here but rewrite it. If we want to figure out how to put the fields, the pi, the k, the eta, in M, because sigma gets an expectation value. The pi, the k, the eta don't get an expectation value. It should be when the fields that correspond to the pi, k, eta are zero, then this just goes over to the vacuum expectation value. So this would be 1, and it would be the vacuum expectation value. The fields are excitations about the expectation. The fields of the pi, k, eta are excitations about the vacuum expectation value of this operator. Everybody with me so far? This is the key point, this representation. Once you have this, the rest follows.
So M is traceless, right?
M is traceless, yes. Traceless Hermitian matrix. How do I figure out how to put the fields in M? Where does the pi plus go versus the pi minus? Where does the k zero bar go versus the k zero? How do I know that? Well, remember we have the unbroken subgroup. And we know where to put the pi, the k, the eta, how they transform under the unbroken subgroup. If I change, for example, a strange quark to an up quark under some transformation in the unbroken SU3, then the K0 has to transform into the strange to up into the pi minus. And I know that. And I know what transformation that is in unbroken SU3 space. And so all I got to do is figure out how M transforms under the unbroken SU3, and then I'll know for sure where I put the pi, the k, and the eta in that matrix, just by performing these transformations on it. Is that clear to everybody? Because the SU3 vector is the unbroken subgroup. We already know how the particles transform under that. We know how to fill out the multiplet. So if I can figure out how M transforms under the unbroken subgroup, I'm good to go. I can put the mesons in M. Okay, so how do we figure that out? Well, the unbroken subgroup has sigma goes to V. So the unbroken subgroup, the SU3 vector is L equals R, we'll call it V then. Okay? And so sigma goes to V sigma V dagger. Similarity transformation, where these are unitary matrices. So I write sigma as a power series in M. You got M to various powers, right? You got the 1, you got the 2im over f, you got the 2im over f squared divided by 2 factorial, yada, yada, yada. I put that in here. And then between every m, I stick in a v dagger v, which is 1. And then I re-exponentiate the series. And we find that sigma, so this is, so we could write this as sigma prime. Sigma goes to sigma prime, which is this. Oh, let me raise this board a bit. Are we at the top level? And so what I've learned is sigma prime is exponential 2i over f vm v dagger. And so this implies that m goes to m prime equals vm v dagger. Once I have that, I go back to the sixth work of Murray Gell-Mann in the 1960s, and I put the particles in M the way he did. So what does that mean? Or I put the fields in. So let me write out for you M. Yes?
So it's a little bit not clear to me why you prefer M, not sigma. To work
with M. Okay, so since sigma came from the operator O, sigma has an expectation value. But the fields, the pi, the k, and the eta, they're the excitations away from that.
Oh, so it's 1 plus.
Right. And furthermore, people don't, there's one more reason that you can see writing it like this, it's very easy to identify how M transforms under the unbroken subgroup. So there, that's the two reasons I wrote that. But different people will write it in different ways because you have this freedom to make field redefinition. But because of those reasons, I usually do it like that. Everybody with me so far? So we've done, I have to write out M, but after that, we've got the basic inputs. We can start to do physics with this formalism. Okay, so let me write out M. Let's step back to the 1960s, open up some paper. And they'll tell you what the octet of mesons is. The normalization I'll make clear in a moment. Oh well, partly just convention, of course, but so that's where they go, if I did it right. Maybe I'll give you, for the TA session this week, a little problem where you'd figure out, for example, this is the right place to put the pi plus in reference to the k plus, making these vector transformations on the fields. But if not, you can say, well, now I understand how it transforms under the vector subgroup. And so I can just look up an old paper and get it. You can figure it out yourself just from transforming stuff. Okay. We got the fields. We got how they transform under the symmetry, these massless fields in this imaginary world where the quark masses are zero. What do we need next? We need a Lagrangian to do dynamics, to calculate cross sections. If you got a particle and you're a particle physicist, you want to scatter it and make a cross section, measure a cross section. So we got to write down a Lagrangian. The Lagrangian has to be invariant under this symmetry, SU3 left cross SU3 right. That's a symmetry of the theory. And let's just start to write down operators that are invariant, could be in our Lagrangian. And in the end, we're going to be working at low momentum physics compared to the scale of strong interactions. And remember, derivatives in amplitudes bring down factors of momenta. So we'll start thinking about a derivative expansion, where we write that, yes?
The problem
We have it in terms of Q, but we want it in terms of these mesons. So there's a whole non-perturbative physics that connects them. It's too hard, so we want to write down an effective Lagrangian in terms of the mesons with the same symmetries as our original one. Okay, so because we're at low momentum, we're going to expand in derivatives to start with. And then I'll try to justify that more as we go forward. But it's a good starting point.
So if you could, if you're all powerful and if you could quantize LQCD at low energies, would we expect to get an effective theory which looks like...
Oh, yeah. I mean, you'd calculate things. You'd put in an interpolating field for the pion. You'd calculate scattering amplitudes of the pion. And it should agree with any prediction of this.
It would, except that would actually give us the value of the parameters.
It would give us the value of the parameters, right. So now we take the parameters from experiment, but you could actually predict their values with the lattice. And I believe the lattice has done that for these. So this is a method that lets you circumvent doing non-perturbative dynamics, but then you can't predict everything. You'll just get you'll have limited predictability. Well, as if you could set this up on a lattice and you were incredibly powerful, you could just compute everything. A lattice being a way to regulate the theory. And then you do Monte Carlo simulations to do the non-perturbative physics. But I'm not that strong. Okay, so let's start. So first, an operator with no derivatives, made up of sigma, that's invariant under SU3 left cross SU3 right. Well, we're going to try to make invariants with traces. So let's say I take trace sigma dagger sigma. Let's see how this transforms. So this goes to trace sigma prime dagger sigma prime, which is trace L sigma right dagger L sigma right, which is trace L trace R dagger sigma L dagger L sigma dagger, L dagger, sigma, right. L dagger, L is the identity. R dagger, R is the identity. So I get trace sigma dagger, sigma. But sigma is a special unitary matrix. Sigma dagger, sigma is the identity. So this is 3. That's no dynamical operator at all. That's just some contribution to the cosmological constant, to the dark energy, which we're not going to talk about. So we started off trying to write an invariant with no derivatives, and the obvious choice didn't work, gave us something that was just a number, and there's nothing with no derivatives. The first operators you can write down that are invariant and aren't just a number, that have the fields in it, some dynamics, involve 2 derivatives. You can't write anything with 1 derivative because you want it to be a Lorentz invariant as well, under special, under the Lorentz group. So the first operators you can write down involve 2 derivatives. And after you think about it, doing things like integrating by parts, you can convince yourself there's only 1 operator, 1 independent operator. And so that'll be our Lagrangian to start. Oh, shoot. Sorry, I didn't look at the clock. So I'm just going to write it down and we'll talk more about it tomorrow. Yeah, that's the great thing about this class. There's always a class tomorrow. So I hit the weekend. But I'm not wrong like when I'm at Caltech and I always say tomorrow. So this will be our Lagrangian plus dot, dot, dot. This is more derivatives. This f squared over 8, you'll see why I put that in before. You can always multiply by something. But you'll see why I did it tomorrow. It's not obvious for you. This is the operator structure. It's clearly invariant under SU3 left cross SU3 right because the L's and R's are global. They move right through these derivatives. So this is where we're going to start tomorrow. Think it over. Come ask me questions if you're confused. There's a lot of subtle physics in this lecture, even though the math didn't seem very complicated. The reason the math doesn't seem complicated is because I don't know any math. I can't make it complicated.